Ladies and gentlemen, this evening after the lecture, coffee will be served in the rotunda. And our speaker has very kindly agreed to answer more questions there. We might, for that reason, cut the question period a bit short and continue it outside. This would be done more often, but it's very expensive. Don't feel guilty, though, about drinking the coffee. The girl will be out at the table, and she'll sell you a membership. And then, you see, you needn't have a guilty conscience. Otherwise, I hope you do. Tonight's lecturer, Professor Harris, is a graduate of this university. After he took his BA here, he went to the University of Montpellier in France, then to the University of Wisconsin. There he took his master's and his doctorate. He taught at the University of Toronto and taught in French at Laval. He taught elsewhere, then returned to the University of British Columbia. His interest in French Canada was, as it is now, in historical geography, and it focused then, which of course leads to tonight's talk, on New France, or the French Canadian. In British Columbia, he has focused on British Columbia historical geography. But tonight's subject is his former interest, or earlier interest, Quebec. It's entitled Quebec and the Canadian Land. Professor Harris.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You know, in 1911, when the University Site Commission decided on the tip of Point Grey as the location for this university, they wanted to surround the precious young of British Columbia with nature and isolate them as much as possible from the nefarious influence of a frontier city. The result is that those of us who teach at this university are more isolated than we should be from the community that we serve. Therefore, for me, as a lecturer here, is a particular pleasure to be here tonight and to be able to give this institute lecture, especially as there are so many people in this audience who I grew up to admire and by whom I have been enormously influenced. I think, for example, of my old social studies teacher over here, John Gibbard, and Harry Warren, who roped me into field hockey more years ago than I now like to think of, and of course, above all, my father. I think any substantial group of people is shaped more than usually they realize by the land they inhabit. And I suspect this has been particularly true of Canadians. Europeans in Canada, after all, have been preoccupied with wresting a living from this vast, raw-boned land, with turning a wilderness into something that could be used. This task has consumed most of our energy. Probably our most central Canadian accomplishment is the settled Canadian land itself, our cities, our fields, our mines, our roads. This land that has absorbed our energy has also molded us. We are not Europeans, most essentially, because of the nature of our encounter with a new land. Some intellectuals in an earlier generation thought we were a distinctive northern people, a product of our long winters, of the hard, rock, crystalline massif of the Canadian Shield, and of a great deal of northern ozone. A northern people were free. Slavery was as southern as it was decadent and invidious. We were vigorous. After all, here only the strong could survive. And because we were all nurtured in a northern clime, we were united. It was a grand vision. It produced much of our nature poetry, produced the landscape painting of the Group of Seven, and it even produced the national anthem, English version. But of course, it's not that simple. We live in northern latitudes, but northernness has not united us. We live with central heating and other place-weakening technological comforts of our age. We spend our winters, many of us, in Hawaii or Florida. Canadian intellectuals stopped believing in the northern myth a generation ago, and I suspect most Canadians, particularly those who've been most enveloped with our wilderness, never believed it. The Canadian Shield delighted weekenders from Toronto while racking pioneers who tried to live there. Our connection with the land is not described by a northern rhetoric that is too simple, too mystical, too chauvinistic. And yet I feel that this land is in our bones, and in good measure I suspect we are what we are because of it. If this is correct, then our national crises will reflect the nature of our landed connection. The particular restlessness of Canada now is in Quebec. I want tonight to talk about Quebecers' relationship with their land, to show that it underlies what they are as a people, and hence their current restlessness. I do so not as a prelude to constitutional solutions, but as a prelude to understanding. From our Cordilleran vantage point, we do not, I think, see across the country very clearly. Quebec hardly comes into focus. We respond, one way or another, to the polemics of political and constitutional debate, but we do not understand the setting that has created it. Here, 3,000 miles away, we have little opportunity to understand, especially with given the quality of our media. But most of the English-speaking in Westmount or Mont Royal do not understand either. And French Canadians themselves, like most people, are what they are without quite knowing why. I noticed that in the wake of the PQ victory, the Quebec license plates declare, I think a little maliciously, je me souviens. But it is true that Quebecers have a particularly direct, a particularly powerful connection with their past. Early in the French regime, a landed relationship was being worked out along the lower St. Lawrence, the echoes of which survive to this day. So I want to begin by talking about the Ancien Régime, that is, about Quebec before 1760, before the English conquest, and then to say something about a changing 19th century Quebec. Finally, I will offer a few remarks, but very, very few, for it's not my expertise, about the situation in Quebec today. Now, oops. I'd like to get the lights a little dimmer, and I'd like a pointer. No, that can stay. I don't know that I need a pointer. Oh, it's there. Look out. I must say, I find this a most intimidating environment. We geographers inhabit an altogether more comfortable building than this. It seems so oppressively modern. Well, as you can see from a slide like this, Europeans had a certain difficulty visualizing the new world. The designer of this cartouche on a map of 1711 knew that the beaver was an animal that carried mud on its tail, knew that the beaver built dams. And so putting that information together and having heard about the spectacular Niagara Falls, came up with a design like this, with Niagara Falls in the background and this collection of industrious coolies in the foreground. Well, I show it really to illustrate not the problems of the European perception of the New World, but to remind you that Canada began not as an agricultural colony, but as a base for the fur trade. And to re... Oops. And to remind you, too, that very quickly along the lower St. Lawrence, a technology was worked out, which, as you can see here, was derived very largely from the Indians, that enabled the French, and later the Anglo-Saxons, who took over the management of the fur trade after 1760, to move very rapidly into the continental interior, to master the Great Lakes Basin, to extend beyond through the watery fringe of the Canadian Shield out into the Lake Winnipeg area and on beyond to probably the Rocky Mountains before 1760. It was a vast undertaking. It produced a remarkable symbiosis in the continental interior of European and Indian ways. But, and this is the point that I want to emphasize about it, it required a relatively small white labor force. The overwhelming majority of the people who worked in the fur trade were Indians. It was Indians who trapped the furs. It was Indians who were the principal middlemen. When the annual fur brigades in the great years of the Montreal-based fur trade set out for the interior post from Montreal, they contained 200, maybe at most 300 young men. Very small group of Europeans scattered exceedingly thinly over a vast continental area. This fact, the slight labor requirements of the fur trade, meant that as the population along the lower St. Lawrence built up, as when eventually several thousand people were living there, there was no longer employment for most young men in the fur trade. This meant, in turn, that in a colony where there was no other major commercial activity, that eventually most of them would have to farm. They'd have to acquire a rotur on some seigneury, a long lot farm. They'd have to take on the wilderness, turn a forest into fields, and settle down, live a sedentary agricultural life. So, if we are thinking about the sort of society that emerged along Canada, along the lower St. Lawrence, in Canada during the French regime, and if we are thinking about its landed connections, what we have to understand is not so much the relationship of traders with the watery, semi-aquatic environment of the fringe of the Canadian Shield, not this vast, thin enterprise going on in the continental interior, but rather, much more intimately, a relationship between society and land here in these terraces along the lower St. Lawrence River. Two very narrow ribbons of land, really, stretching on one side of the river between the Shield and the St. Lawrence, and on the other side, south to the Appalachian Highlands. Not very much agricultural land, only a few miles away to the north and to the south, the rather forbidding unagricultural environments of Shield and Appalachian Highlands. Well, of course, not very many French people in the 17th or 18th centuries wanted to come to this place. Voltaire had described it as so many appons de neige. The characteristic French perception of Canada must have been, for those Frenchmen who'd heard of this remote place at all, a setting where if one was lucky enough to survive the rigors of a severe winter, one was likely to lose one's topknot to a wandering Indian in the summer. The result was that in the 150 years of the French regime, only about 500 people came to Canada of their own volition, people who had pulled up their stakes in France and had decided to create a new life for themselves in Canada.
The others came simply because they had been sent. They came as soldiers, probably at first without the slightest intention of remaining in Canada. They came as indentured servants. They came as prisoners, relatively small group towards the end of the French regime. And quite early on, in the 1660s and 1670s, about 1,000 women had been sent out to be brides. But these people came from the lower strata of French society. They may not have been destitute, but they were certainly not prosperous. They didn't, in short, have a clear niche in French society to return to. And after a time, when their years of military service, when their period of indenture had been worked out, there was, for most, no choice but to settle down in Canada, to take out a farm lot, and to try and make something of the North American wilderness. So what we've got to try and understand before we can begin to cope, I think, with the changes that took place in Quebec in the 19th century, or even for that matter to understand the restless Quebec of the present day, is to see a little more clearly the sort of society that emerged along the lower St. Lawrence in this early period, when a relative handful of not too enthusiastic Europeans found themselves, for want of anything better to do, forced to try and farm in this harsh and really unappealing environment. Now, if we are to understand that encounter, it is important to remember just a few things about the France that they had left. This 17th century France was, of course, already an old, much used, densely settled land. France had a far larger population than any other European country at the beginning of the 17th century. There were about 20 million people. It was an overwhelmingly rural population, 90 to 93, 94% rural. The rural population densities, approximately 40 people per square kilometer. This was a densely settled land that had already pushed itself to the limits of its landed, its agrarian possibilities. This, of course, was not then, nor was it soon to be, an industrial France. It was a profoundly agrarian place. The whole socioeconomic hierarchy of 17th century France depended, finally, on the control of agricultural land. And those people were prosperous, those people were powerful, those people held status in this society who controlled land. And those people who did not were vulnerable. Well, a situation like this, where there's a heavy pressure of people on land, would create, of course, a situation in which land was valuable and also where labor, as there were 20 million Frenchmen casting around for land, casting around for work, where labor was cheap. Here is a fundamental relationship that, if one is to understand what happened along the lower St. Lawrence, one has to remember. The French who came to Canada came out of a setting where land was scarce and expensive and labor was abundant and cheap. In this setting, of course, as I say, those with land were the powerful. And a whole, oh, drat, and a whole hierarchy of French wealth and status rested ultimately on those who worked the land. Now, some of you may have visited this magnificent Loire Chateau. It's a Chenonceau and a tiny tributary of the Loire. There's a gallery built out over the river. There's this magnificent Italian garden. You can perhaps imagine the sumptuous, the elegant life and the evening party, the finely dressed people, if I can get this thing to work, yes, walking along this wall, observing the flickering shadows cast by enormous candles that were carried on the back of even more enormous tortoises as they were guided along these raked gravel paths. Well, it was an elegant life when you're up near the top of the French landed hierarchy. But of course, a place like Chenonceau rested on hundreds and thousands of acres of land cultivated by very ordinary people who were paying heavily into seigneurial coffers to support this sort of luxury. And on beyond it, the very pinnacle of this landed system, of course, at Versailles. And here again, this magnificent environment, depending very substantially, more than half of the royal revenue, coming from a particularly onerous tax known as the taille, which was imposed on the ordinary peasantry of France, who paid a third to a half of their annual income to the monarch, paid a good deal more to their senior, and a good deal more to their priest. A whole oppressive panoply of fiscal burdens sat over the ordinary folk of France. Well, here's the other end, if you will, of that landed hierarchy in 17th century France. Pre-industrial textures, an intensely local, rooted, vernacular France. The textures would differ in different parts of the country, but the intimate connection of people living close to the land, as revealed in this slide, was everywhere there. Now, for these people, of course, the glitter of Chenonceau, or the even more extravagant glitter of Versailles, was altogether out of their world. There was absolutely no chance that they would ever get there, or even much less far up the hierarchy of French status and power. They might in their dreams, they might in their folk tales. There the prince would come and put the glass slipper on a peasant foot, or there the little tailor would eventually marry the king's daughter. But it didn't happen in reality. The aspiration of the ordinary peasant of 17th century France was very much less grand than that. What he wanted to do, above all, was to avoid as much as he could the oppressive crush of taxes that bore upon him, to acquire a minimum of financial security so that he and his family could live with some ease, with some expectation that they would get through the next indifferent harvest and that they would pay next year's taxes. Now, the only way to do this for the overwhelming majority of people in 17th century France was to acquire a sufficient tract of land. And of course, that was not easily done because of the price of land and because of the exceedingly low cost of labor. In every village in France, though, there were a few people who the English would have called yeoman farmers, and the French would call laboureurs. That is, peasants who had acquired enough land to live on their own, to move out of the collective routine of open field village life, to enclose their own land, to make their own agricultural decisions. Well, here we are in a village not far from the Dordogne River, and a house like this is perhaps the house of such a yeoman, of such a laboureur. But even in a village like that, not very far away, was another power. This magnificent spot, I mean, really, it's just, I remember being completely overwhelmed by the beauty of this spot when 10 years ago I visited it. The Dordogne River, the limestone crags, and this extraordinary building in the foreground. What is it? Well, it's a dovecot. What sort of society provides such a wonderful roost for its doves? Well, an aristocratic society, of course. And in fact, just out of this picture, over in here, was the ruins of a chateau. So the little village, people of various socioeconomic station there, but overlooking the whole thing, this seigneurial power. But here is the a landscape that reveals, I think fairly clearly, the basic aspiration of the ordinary people of France. It is to acquire their own house, to acquire their own land, and as I say, to acquire a modicum of independence. As the French would have said, to be able to vivre du sien, to live on one's own, d'être un bon ménager, to be a good manager, to be able to push off this oppressive world of fiscal power that bore so heavily on the French peasantry. But of course in France, only a tiny number of people could do so. Perhaps 5, 7, 8% of the peasantry. There was just not enough land. There were always people who, when prices rose, when harvests were poor, dropped out of the toehold, lost their toehold to land, and became one of that group who wandered, that considerable group who wandered and begged. So this, in essence, is the landed connection of the people who were crossing the Atlantic to Canada. So, over 150 years, 10,000 people came to the St. Lawrence lowlands. What did they find? They found a vast forest, all right. They found land that had already been granted, because this colony was intended to be a thoroughly conservative place. There were no radical ideas whatsoever that animated the French government in establishing Canada. Therefore, French institutions came holus bolus across the Atlantic to Canada. Land, therefore, was conceded in seigneuries. If you wanted access to land as an ordinary person, you had to go to a seigneur and apply for a lot. A retour is the official name for one of these things, the legal name for one of these things, or a long lot farm. But of course, land was everywhere. Seigneuries were almost worthless. Seigneurs competed for many years for settlers. There were not enough people to go around. In this situation, land, of course, was free. Now, eventually, a man who took a lot like that would have to pay a certain amount in annual seigneurial dues. But if he were lucky, the better part of a generation might go by before the senior, who was likely involved in the fur trade and had no connection with his seigneury, would bother to try and collect anything. So the move across the Atlantic suddenly changed the structure of the relationship of ordinary people to land. It was possible, because there was an abundance of land, for anyone in Canada to acquire land. Oops, not the right thing. And gradually, of course, this land was cleared. Now, it's impossible from this distance to visualize very clearly the settled landscapes of the St. Lawrence lowland in the 17th century. The landscape has been transformed mightily since then, and in many parts of the St. Lawrence lowland has been substantially urbanized. But here's a slide taken behind the shrine at St. Anne de Beaupré that I think captures something of the feel of the landscape as it must have looked in 1670, in 1680, as these tiny farms were beginning to be wrought out of the wilderness. Of course, that forest is by no means the primeval forest. It's third or fourth or fifth generation. It had relatively stunted trees compared to those that the pioneers would have encountered. But the sense of isolation, the sense of being alone on one's own land is there. So what was happening, of course, is that people who came across the Atlantic acquired what they could not in France, namely their own farmland. Now this acquisition in one sense, legally, was easy enough. You just went to a senior and asked, and you got a lot, you paid nothing. But then, of course, the work began. There was a forest to be cleared. There were strange animals to contend with. There were Indians around. As elsewhere in North America, the frontier was a racking experience. We know that there was a good deal of insanity on the North American frontier, particularly among women, as the men would get out, would be involved with other men and get into the town occasionally, but the women were likely to be far more sequestered in a hovel somewhere off in the bush, coping with dirt, coping with sniveling brats, and quietly going mad. And I think if you can imagine a girl coming out of Paris in 1666, 1667, not absolutely destitute, but not with very much money, coming across the Atlantic, barely surviving a harrowing trip, marrying a week after she arrived, a man, of course, she had no previous knowledge of, and finding herself a few days later settled down somewhere on a long lot farm or an incipient farm on the edge of the Canadian Shield. Well, I think you can imagine something of how difficult this was. Any number of people simply did not make it. They gave up, they died. But there's some pluses in the situation. For one thing, there was wood around. People quickly claimed that in Canada they were not nearly as cold as French peasants were in France, where fuel was exceedingly scarce. And of course, too, there was game. There was fish in the river, there were deer, there were birds. But even there, of course, the French peasantry had, for the most part, no connection with hunting. Hunting was a prerogative of the rich. The deer were protected on royal and noble estates. In fact, I remember one poignant document in the collection of the Séminaire de Québec pertaining to an event that had taken place in the 1640s, miles along the bank of the St. Lawrence River. What had happened, of course, as the initial pioneering encounter with the land was left behind, was that with everybody having enough land to build a farm, a society emerged that had all the characteristics of the lesser levels of the English yeomanry or the class of French laboureurs. The really poor dropped away. There was land. One didn't have to beg. One could acquire a farm. And sooner or later, everybody did. There are all sorts of indications that the average standard of living of ordinary people rose along the lower St. Lawrence if compared with the situation in France. People lived a little longer. People married a little younger. The mortality rate in the first year of infancy was lower. Characteristically, habitant farmers owned a horse, an unheard of luxury in France. So what had happened is that the bottom tiers of the French rural hierarchy had simply dropped away. People acquired a certain rough ease. But there the situation stopped. And it stopped because in this isolated interior colony, there was simply no market for agricultural produce. Nobody could work particularly hard, could invest particularly in stock or equipment or land and expect to prosper from that work or that investment. There was a tiny market for agricultural produce in the towns, two or three times only. In the whole span of the French regime, agricultural products were sent to France, but France was 3,000 miles away, and Canada was not, of course, a plantation colony. It produced the same crops as were grown in France. And the French West Indies could be reached, but only after an exceedingly perilous, lengthy voyage. There was little agricultural market there. And so a situation that boosted the circumstances of the poor also put a lid on achievement. One could go so far in this society, and one could not go any farther. One could get a small farm with 40 or 50 or 60 acres cleared, a house, a few outbuildings, fences around the whole thing, three or four cows, a few pigs and some sheep, an essentially subsistent agricultural operation, and that was it. Now this fact, The weakness of the market meant, of course, that the French social grades on above the yeoman farmer didn't exist in this society either. The seniors came in, but to own a seniory meant essentially nothing in fiscal terms, and nothing in status terms either. In the earliest days, a seniory of 15, 30, 40 square miles could be exchanged for the price of a couple of cows. The seniors simply could not profit from their holdings. They could not sell the land. If they turned their land to agricultural production, they could not sell their products. So the seigneurial system was blocked for this basic financial reason. And similarly, the penetration of the bourgeoisie was blocked. Whereas in 17th century France, there had been a massive movement of the merchant class, the newly prosperous merchant class, out into the countryside, displacing seniors, buying up landed property. This did not happen in Canada. And it did not happen simply because no merchant with his head screwed on at all would risk capital in such a useless venture as land along the lower St. Lawrence. There was simply no return on an investment. And so what one gets is a curiously egalitarian society emerging along the lower St. Lawrence during the French regime. It has a certain robustness about it. Not only are people relatively healthy, but there are other signs of vigor. There are any number of intendant's ordinances enjoining people horsemen are not to knock over pedestrians. And people coming to church of a Sunday morning are to walk rather than to gallop their horses and buggies within a mile of church. One has some sense of the mayhem of Montreal traffic adumbrated along the lower St. Lawrence in the 17th century. You have just a bit of the feeling, too, that this was the sort of society that you might expect to produce a hockey team that plays the way the Montreal Canadiens play rather than the Boston Bruins. There was an awful lot of drinking. But there doesn't seem to have been much promiscuity. There are very few illegitimate births. And yet at the same time, it seems fairly clear that the hand of the church did not sit particularly heavily on this society. There are many cases in the documents of the bishop deciding that, well, the population in such and such an area had got to the point where a resident priest could be established. But the habitant would write, or find somebody who could write, because most of them were illiterate, and say that, look, they got on very well for years without a resident priest, that it was fine having a missionary priest come along in winter and in summer to baptize the latest crop of kids and say belated masses for the dead. And please, thank you very much, we just don't need this newcomer. He was going to cost a certain amount. He was likely to be French. He was likely to disapprove of the amount of drinking that went on in the countryside. So a certain boisterousness there, certainly a rough self-sufficiency, but absolutely no luxury. This was a very different society from that which existed in the French countryside. And before very long, the habitants along the lower St. Lawrence were well aware that it was different. They called themselves Canadiens, or for that matter, habitants, people who lived in Canada. And they were well aware when a Frenchman came that he was not one of them. And indeed, after a generation, he could not have been, because the circumstances of life on the two sides of the Atlantic were so fundamentally different. Well, this is about as far as the wealth that the countryside of the lower St. Lawrence during the French regime, about as much wealth as it could produce, a house of approximately this size. A very comfortable place, but you put it alongside the glories of Chenonceau, and it seems very, very mean, very rustic, very ordinary indeed. By the way, this picture was taken on a field trip out from Laval during the summer when I was trying with my rusty French to lecture to a class that fortunately was almost entirely nuns. And they therefore were extraordinarily obliging. I asked them after the first lecture if I were being understood, and they said, "Oh, oui, monsieur, ça va très bien." And I was somewhat encouraged. But then at the end of the week, that little nun, she came up and she said, "Oh, monsieur," she said, "you're making wonderful progress. I'm actually beginning to understand you." Which I thought put the whole thing into fairly clear perspective. And in fact, just a few minutes after this slide was taken, we were back in the bus, and I had announced that we would be stopping shortly to buy to consume our bagged lunches at a ski resort a few miles farther on, behind Saint-Anne de Beaupré. And this little nun, she turned to me and she says, "Monsieur, vous savez qu'il y a les noces là-bas? Do you know that there are wedding parties there?" But I thought she said, "Monsieur, vous savez qu'il y a les ours là-bas? You know that there are bears there." And so I turned to her, and as severely as I could, really putting it on, I said, "Sir," I said, "have you brought your gun?" And they had all known that they were dealing with a rather peculiar character, a peculiar Anglais, and that settled it. There was very little to punctuate the monotony of this simple agrarian landscape, a landscape where everybody had about the same goods of this world, where nobody had much more or much less than anyone else. But here and there, when the population warranted it, and when the local population decided they would take him, parish priests were established. And here and there, parish churches of this sort emerged. Now, I show you this slide not because it has any particular point in the lecture I'm giving, but because I think it's probably the finest building has been put up in this country. It was demolished just over 120 years ago. But these early parish churches along the lower St. Lawrence, if one is to understand them, I guess they're most simply seen as a fusion of an essentially Baroque aesthetic coming in with the elite in the 17th century, and a medieval craftsmanship of stone masonry. In any event, tiny churches serving a very small, very scattered population, but I think beautiful churches. Now, the society I have been describing was not the whole society in Canada during the French regime. There were two principal towns, Quebec and Montreal, and throughout the French regime, they contained approximately 25% of the population, a very large percentage in any colonial pre-industrial situation. In these towns, there were was of course the military establishment, the bureaucratic establishment, the strong ecclesiastical institutional side as well. In the towns, there were commercial opportunities. The fur trade funneled through these places. And in the towns, there was a considerable social stratification based on administrative position, administrative and military position, based on wealth. The French who came to Canada found the towns very familiar. They were wont to say that that Quebec reminded them of a small provincial town in Normandy. Montreal seemed a little odder. It was more rough. It was more frontierish. There were the Indians would come in the spring. It was the jumping off point to the west. It didn't ring quite so true, but basically, these towns had reproduced far more of the elements of French life than had the countryside. And the basic point I want to make about them is that there really were two societies in Canada during the French regime. There was this urban one, French in its in many of its characteristics, and a rural society, a relatively powerless society in some respects. Certainly none of the important people of the French regime lived there, but numerically, by far, the largest group. And of course, what is going to happen when the English come along and Quebec is conquered is that these urban societies in Quebec and in Montreal are going to be quickly, very largely, displaced. A lot of people are going to go back to France. A French military and civil bureaucracy will be replaced by an English one. French ecclesiastical power was for a long time virtually frozen. The church was not allowed to make new recruits. And even very quickly, French-speaking businessmen were being squeezed out by a group of Scots and New Englanders who were probably more aggressive, more relentless competitors than the French were used to, and who certainly were far more connected to the new, to the commercial houses on the other side of the Atlantic on which the colony depended, and houses that were now in the British Isles. It was a very difficult competitive environment for a French-speaking merchant. And before very long, by about the 1780, they have been effectively squeezed out of the fur trade. The fur trade took 20 years, but in those 20 years, the management and the capitalization of the fur trade shifts into English-speaking hands. What happens is that the towns effectively became English-speaking places. French-speaking people left the towns, poured out into the countryside, whereas in 1750, 25% of the population along the lower St. Lawrence was urban. In 1800, only about 3% of the French-Canadian population lived in Quebec, in Three Rivers, or in Montreal. In all of those places, the majority of the population in 1800, and in Montreal until much later than that, the majority of the population was English speaking. Now, French Canadian society then, in the wake of the conquest, was to a very substantial extent decapitated. And it turned to its rural self. It turned, therefore, to this institutionally very simple society that I have been describing along the lower St. Lawrence during the French regime. Let me say just a few things about what happened to this society in the 100, 120 years or so after the conquest. Of course, there was no more French immigration, but there was very rapid population increase. Births just about at the biological limit, 55, 60, 65 births per 1,000 people per year. The death rate varied depending on depending on epidemics, but on average it was between 25 and 30 per 1,000 per year. Well, you could figure it out. This means a population doubling about every 26, every 27 years. So the 65 to 80,000 people in Canada during the French regime had become by 1860, about a million French-speaking people. But a million French-speaking people, profoundly agricultural, turned out of the towns, turned toward the countryside, coping with, by 1860, an extraordinarily meager agricultural base. Here one has to remember the fundamental geographical realities of agricultural life along the lower St. Lawrence. A few miles away to the north, the fringe of the Canadian Shield, and an intractable agricultural environment. A few miles to the south, the Appalachian Highlands. Off to the west, to be sure, land that might have become a theater for French-Canadian settlement, but by early in the 19th century, it was beginning to be settled by English-speaking people, most of whom were out of Scotland, were out of Ireland, very strong orange tinge, militantly Protestant, militantly monarchical, not at all the sort of society that was in any way congenial for a French Canadian contemplating leaving the familiar lands of the St. Lawrence lowlands. So in effect, French Canada in the 19th century was being boxed in. The place was simply running out of land. Here we confront the essential dilemma of 19th century Quebec, a dilemma from which, in a certain sense, Quebec is only now extricating itself. The fact of an overwhelmingly agricultural people, a people whose aspiration, whose rhetoric, whose symbolization and memory of themselves had become profoundly agricultural, but operating essentially without an agrarian base. A fundamentally tragic situation. And here you can see what begins to happen. The settlement pushes away from the St. Lawrence lowlands, back towards the fringe of the Canadian Shield, or here, south of the river, the Appalachian Highlands. Then it stops. Can't go any farther, at least not for the time. And the farms along the lower St. Lawrence begin to be subdivided. The land that a man holds is drops. Living standards begin to fall. Rural poverty begins to become characteristic. And the other side of the coin, of course, is that those with land in this situation, we're coming back to a relationship that has echoes of the situation in 17th century France, those with land, like the seigneurial class, are now in a position to prosper. They may sell new roturiers, they may jack the charges that they level on old roturiers, they may cultivate the seigneurial domain and hoard grain to sell it in the spring when prices are likely to be high. And buildings like this begin to appear in the countryside. This is the home of a seigneurial agent, or a seigneur's bailiff. This is located on the outskirts of Saint-Louis-de-Lobinière, and there is this power that was not there in the French regime, looking over the situation, keeping an eye on the tenants, seeing that the seigneur's rights and prerogatives are observed. So a new poverty and a new wealth is being inserted in the countryside. Now that wealth is never going to produce a Chenonceau, but it does begin to produce comfortable, small, seigneurial manors. Some of them, I think, really quite exquisite, like this one at Saint-Antoine de Tilly, just a few miles this side of Quebec City on the south shore. Building of the late 18th century with a porch added in the middle of the 19th century. And a slightly larger manor house like this one. This is the Taschereau Manor in the Beauce, the Taschereau family that produced, I think, a couple of Quebec premiers. Well, you can see the landed relationship in the 19th century has changed. Those with land are in a position to prosper, and those who have little land are again economically vulnerable. There is a widening gap, a widening socioeconomic gap, a gap of status, of power, and of wealth in the French Canadian countryside. You can see it in all sorts of ways. If one examines the parish records attentively, there are prosperous farmers, there are poor farmers. The notary is becoming a figure of some distinction. The priest is a much more influential figure in this society. There's more money around for his support. He lives better. And against all of this, there is now acute hardship out there too, especially in times of, as in the 1830s, 1840s, conditions absolutely desperate along the lower St. Lawrence when the basic crop, wheat, was attacked by midge and the Hessian fly. And there is starvation in the French Canadian countryside, as year after year there had been in the countryside of France, but as there had not been along the lower St. Lawrence during the French regime. The power of the church growing, as I've suggested. There's the church I showed you earlier on the left. But you see this new church, far bigger, far more resplendent inside, but architecturally a barn compared to the earlier one, is being built. Part of the reason for the growing power of the church is simply that in the extreme institutional weakness of Canada after French Canada after the conquest, with civil government in English hands, with business in English hands, with the military in English hands, the church was the one institution that remained as a possible fulcrum of French Canadian life. And there seems to me to be almost no doubt that it strengthened substantially in this period. And that the characteristic image that we so commonly have in English Canada of a French Canadian peasantry dominated by its parish priests, well, I don't think it's ever an entirely accurate image, but it comes much closer to making some sense in this 19th century period than it ever did during the French regime. Basically, what I want to point out is that this situation, as it developed in the 19th century, was increasingly damaging for most ordinary French Canadians. They simply could no longer make a go of it. There was not enough land there. Acute rural poverty develops, and it remains in many parts of Quebec. This is the sort of landscape that elects créditistes to Ottawa. A picture like this, it seems to me, I may be laying it on a little bit, but a picture like this, it seems to me, sums up the predicament that French Canada was in the mid-late 19th century. Underneath all this Victorian gingerbread, you can see the lines of the earlier French Canadian house, the slightly bell-cast roof, the simple symmetry, but look how it's been gussied up in a tawdry and incomprehending way. That barge board on the gable end, this ridiculous semi-Gothic portico over the door and all the neoclassical trim. An alien world has come into a vulnerable society, and that society has picked up bits and pieces of it in this sort of mishmash. What eventually, of course, is going to happen is that this conservative, retrospective society, unable to adjust itself internally, with a very weak institutional base for change, can only cope with a changing situation, tragically, by exporting its young. It can maintain itself as it is by getting rid of its young. Farms cannot be divided any farther. The young people will have to leave. A conservative agricultural tradition allowed, finally, no alternative. Well, where are people going to go? Early in the 19th century, beginning about 1810, I think I'm taking too long, but beginning about 1810, French Canadians began to migrate into the fringe of the Canadian Shield, take on its acid soils, its boreal forest, its rocks. There they encountered, I suppose, two protagonists. One was the physical environment of the Canadian Shield itself, and the other was an industrial system that was already established there. They encountered, in short, the timber trade, a timber trade that was in the hands entirely of English-speaking managers, English-speaking foremen and bosses. The capital was Scottish, was English, was from New England, and some of it by this time was second-generation Canadian. But none of it was French-Canadian. So a man who went into the bush early in the 19th century became a laborer. He worked in the camps, the chantier, around the fringe of the Canadian Shield, or a little later, by the middle of the 19th century, perhaps he worked in the new sawmills that were being built. Because there were so many people seeking these jobs, wages were extraordinarily low. A man could only find work for 4 or 5 months of the year. For that work, he was paid, well, in the 1820s, about $8 a month. by 1840, 1850, wages had risen to $10 or $12 a month. Now, it's hard to compare dollar values, of course. The dollar bought vastly more than it does at the present day. But remember that in 1858, miners working the gravels a few miles from us on the Fraser River were quitting if they couldn't earn $5 to $7 to $8 a day. So these were, take my word for it, even though the dollar bought vastly more than it does now, these were starvation wages. They gave a man $40 or $50 or $60 a year. And he had no guarantee that he would be employed the next year. With so many men seeking work, many employers made a habit of rotating work around, of not hiring the same men in consecutive years. For after all, work was a luxury rather than a right. So French-Canadian laborers, along with the even more destitute Irish, encountered the timber trade in the fringe of the Canadian Shield. But they also would take out land in the back of some of the seigneuries or farther back beyond the seigneurial land in the townships, and they would try and clear it and farm it. Now, a painting of Cornelius Krieghoff's makes this look like a delightful romantic scene, the horse, the good housewife, and so on. And we think of rural felicity and the simple rectitude of a pre-industrial age. But this was a crushingly hard life. A place like this looks rather good to us. If we lived in Montreal, if we were thinking of skiing in the Laurentians, well, you buy a place like that, fix it up, have a fine ski cabin. But if you had to live in that, if you had to live in that in the 1840s or 1850s, it would have been the second house that would have been built on this lot. The first was a one-room shanty with a one-sloped roof. And if you had to try and farm the 3 or 4 acres that was the absolute limit that you could wring from this land, and if you had to go off and work in the timber camps for what the little you could earn, this was a prison. Really, the whole Canadian Shield experience was a disaster for French Canada. What it did was delay the accommodation to the urban industrial world that was eventually going to have to be made. Two generations of energy went into this sort of thing, and the inevitable result was failure. In this particular area, this is in the seigneury of Petit Nation, Louis-Joseph Papineau's seigneury. A few of you may have visited the seigneury club at Montebello. In this particular seigneury, there was a Baptist merchant. His name was Stephen Tucker. Going through the land records of the seigneury, I found that Stephen Tucker owned 40 farms. Now, where did he get them? Everybody in Petit Nation was in debt. Almost everybody. Every French Canadian except Louis-Joseph Papineau. They were in debt to Louis-Joseph Papineau, and they were in debt to Stephen Tucker. Papineau was by far the more generous creditor. Stephen Tucker would foreclose. And these people would go. They'd drift off to another lumber camp. They'd go down into the slums of Montreal. They'd go to the burgeoning industrial towns of New England. I also found in Petit Nation 20 French-Canadian families who declared themselves as Baptists. Now, what are Baptists, French-Canadian Baptists, in the 1860s doing in Petit Nation? Well, that took a while to figure out, but I eventually found that Stephen Tucker, the old rascal, was offering any of his debtors $40 if they would switch from the Catholic to the Baptist fold. Now, $40 is a year's work. And when it's the difference between having a farm for a little longer and not having a farm, well, 20 families had made the switch. How long they remained as Baptists, I never did find out. But that is pressure. That is economic pressure in the raw. And that is what French Canadians were encountering when they moved into the Canadian Shield. And of course, they brought no institutional base whatever to protect themselves from that sort of pressure. They brought a family structure. They brought eventually, when they could afford to bring him in,